You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. Today's topic is broad in scope, one that I really hope we can visit multiple times. One episode, one podcast will not do it justice. It is a topic full of misinformation, misunderstanding, and missed opportunity. We are talking today about autism, something that affects an estimated 1 in 36 children, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
So this is not a disease. It's rather a spectrum of neurological differences with multiple presentations. We know that the autistic experience is not monolithic. And we want to acknowledge that understanding and treatment will really evolve as we learn more.
It's true, Maya. And I think that the evolution arc is very long because I'm just thinking about all the questions I have for today's episode and so much that I'm reflecting on in my professional life, my personal life. But how has autism shown up in your profession, Maya? How have you dealt with it and personally as well?
So, in my work as a dietitian, I am often part of an interdisciplinary care team. And we are working with folks who have higher needs. So the dietitians on my team, we actually go in-home for services like activities of daily living related to cooking. So everything from getting your groceries to planning it out, to preparing the meal, and then sitting down to have the meal. And that's really our role as part of that interdisciplinary care team. We will also modify the nutrition if there's another diagnosis that is present. But that is just my experience as a dietitian with those particular patients and those particular families that we work with. I reached out to a woman named Sally Ann Jacobs, who is not a patient of mine. She is a mom and an advocate. She is a mother to two children who are now 18 that have autism. And I had this great conversation with her. And yes, it's unique to her, but I wanted to just share a little bit of what she said to me because it gives a different lens. And she said, when you take a step back and you meet one person on the spectrum, you have met the one person on the spectrum, full stop. She said, they're not Rain Man. They're not the good doctor. And what Sally Ann Jacobs said to me that I thought was so interesting, Kavita, was that when you interact with any person on the spectrum, that you've got to listen and take their words rather than looking for those socially acceptable responses that we all expect to get from people who are quote unquote neurotypical. So, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, and there's a lot that's changed over time. And, you know, the truth is, I feel like we know what we know now, and it'll evolve in the future as we engage in more research and autism awareness becomes more mainstream as a part of disability movements. Kavita, for you, do you recall when you first started working with persons with autism? And I want you to share a little bit about what you learned in medical school versus what you actually experience in practice.
Yeah, I'll actually start with my first kind of impression of persons with autism. It was the movie Rain Man.
Ray, can we try something?
Yeah.
Do you know how much 312 times 123 is?
38376.
He's right.
What?
He's right.
He's right?
Yeah. Ray, how much is 4,343 times 1,234?
5359262.
He's a genius.
That's right. He's a genius. Ray, do you know how much the square root of 2,130 is?
46.15192304.
2304. I mean, that is amazing. He should work for NASA or something like that.
Those of you who don't know the movie, because it's decades old now, Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman brothers, who Dustin Hoffman at the time had kind of what would probably now be called a spectrum disorder, but was kind of painted as this like counting cards, quirky genius that could win money for his brother, Tom Cruise, in Las Vegas. And that was right when I was going to medical school. I will tell you that some of the old medical school textbooks in the 60s and 70s, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which some of our textbooks still dated back to then, sadly, actually had concepts of autism linked to childhood schizophrenia. That was really the origin of kind of how psychiatry in the mid 20th century had referred to them. And there's a concept that maybe some listeners recall called refrigerator mothers. There was this now very well debunked kind of hypothesis and research that thought that perhaps that autism was really a problem because there were emotionally distant mothers, and they call them refrigerator mothers, kind of shifting accountability away from any possible biologic cause. Certainly that's evolved. And then in the 80s, we then got formal diagnosis. And then that was when in the 90s, I entered medical school. So we had a much more established concept of autism as a spectrum. We did kind of probably put a lot of attention to what would have been called Asperger's disorder and childhood developmental disorder. I think that there is now like a desire to consolidate that. So as I was moving from medical school into residency, fellowship, and then practice, I kind of saw this spectrum also evolve of caregiving and better understanding of, you know, what kind of care, how to make the diagnosis, a lot of like attention to the need for really comprehensive testing to establish. And again, there's no diagnosis, it's not a disease, but to kind of think about like characteristics for persons with autism, including what I think was the hardest and toughest, along with we have to put diagnoses down for insurance purposes, for help with getting referrals. And I think that led a lot of both physicians, myself included, to really kind of hanging on to treatments and with that potentially cures. So I did see a shift from when I started training and practicing of a cure. And then I think what's happened today, the majority, I only take care of adults, the majority of what I see, whether it's direct patient care or anecdotal colleagues of mine, is this intense backlog. The interdisciplinary team that you are a part of, Maya, we now have in the Washington, D.C. area, 6 to 9 month wait to even establish a diagnosis. So can you imagine being Sally Ann and being a mom? Doesn't even matter what kind of resources you have. You can have all the resources in the world, all the money, social resources in the world. But if you're sitting there with children and you're trying to make a diagnosis or think about what to do, and every single day, and you're kind of tortured because you can't get appointments, that's the world I'm in right now. So I realize my lens is incredibly overly clinical, but I would say that I'm constantly struck at just how, even though I just told you we've shifted from refrigerator mothers to childhood schizophrenia to, I would say, a much more evolved concept of persons with autism and the spectrum that that involves, is it not pathetic and sad that our care is still incredibly hard to access and incredibly hard to find? Oh, and incredibly hard to pay for, I should say.
Oh, it's unbelievably expensive. I mean, Kavita, the thing that shocks me is that to put together one of those multidisciplinary care teams outside of a hospital system is really just for a select few.
Right.
And yes, we're doing incredibly good work, and we are really taking care of the caregivers and the patients. But the truth is, as you said, there are waiting lists. And I know of stories of people who are using public services, and it's been months and 12 months when you have an 18-month-old child is like a lifetime.
And it's very interesting to find kind of the racial and ethnic lines as well. I've had many conversations. My population is Central South American, and there's no equivalent phrase for persons with autism that doesn't have some, that doesn't necessarily throw back to some of those stereotypes and horrible myths that I mentioned from the mid 20th century.
Yep.
And so it's not just all the barriers to access, depending on the color of your skin and kind of where you're from, it can feel like an infinite ocean to get to some sort of diagnosis or some sort of support system.
And let's not forget the stigma right?
Because right, that's exactly right.
So you add stigma to that list of challenges and barriers because it's socially acceptable for people to look down on anyone who has a disability. They are constantly othered.
Yeah, and if I'm being honest, it's very hard for me to have the conversations without feeling like I step into that too. I'm always very conscious of, or try to be, of my own bias. And it's very clear that even I'm not sure sometimes what I'm stepping into, if I'm contributing to that stigma directly.
Yeah.
Because it's very clear, especially when I have adults with diagnoses or something written in their charts, that it's there have been just sometimes characterized as difficult patients, sometimes right. characterized as, you know, persons that are hard to treat. That type of chart stigma exists too, and it's real. I think about it a lot, and I step into it. And in preparing for this episode, wondered if I've intentionally shied away from people and populations of care with autism. I asked a colleague about that. I said, what percentage of our panel do you think might carry this in their charts? And we all were kind of trying to scratch our heads figuring that out, but it was a moment of confronting our own biases. Well, this will be a great conversation to bring another voice into this, because when we come back, we're going to speak with reporter Sarah Luderman on how persons with autism and their communities are finding ways to support each other and what they define as wellness. Stay tuned.
Well, now, listeners, if you're enjoying the show and you want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Wednesday morning. And while you're there, you can check out our other episodes too, like last week's, all about debunking the BS to get to truly healthy skin with the doc, my dermatologist, Dr. Ardarsh Vijayamudgil. Check it out. Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. It's Autism Acceptance and Awareness Month. And joining us for our conversation on wellness and autism is Sarah Luderman. She's currently the caregiving reporter for the 19th and has a long career covering disability policy, politics, and culture. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, we like to start with like a very basic question that we ask every single interviewee. How do you define wellness? And this is not a gotcha question. There's no right or wrong answer, but it's always just hearing it in your own words. How do you define wellness?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question for me because I actually kind of hate wellness as a concept. Just like as someone who is born with a disability, I find that wellness often encompasses things that are like really harmful, like quack cures, for example. I mean, there are things that people do to their autistic kids, like bleach drinking or like more benign stuff like camel milk or gluten-free, casein-free diets. And like all of those things tend to sort of get like wrapped up in wellness. And so I just like, whenever I hear wellness, like even the more benign versions, I just get this like, well, have you tried yoga kind of vibe from it. So I don't think of wellness as a goal for myself. I think about functionality and joy. So like there are things that I do because I need to do them in order to be functional and experience joy. I need to have good sleep hygiene and go to bed at a regular hour. I need to eat a vegetable every once in a while. I need to take my psych meds. Those are things that I need to do in order to like live a good life, but I just don't think about them as wellness, even though I think a lot of other folks might.
By the way, I too feel like wellness becomes a lot of like yoga and meditation. It's partly why we like asking it, because even as hosts, we answer it ourselves very differently, which I think is probably more reflective of a broader scope of the population. But you also have not just your personal experience, but I've been reading your articles and kind of your work, which covers quite a broad spectrum. So we are focusing, as we kind of mentioned, around autism, all the aspects that I think you've also covered in your reporting. How does your personal experience kind of intersect with how you cover the topics that you'd have been writing about?
I think being autistic and just being part of the broader disability community has actually had a huge impact on my reporting. The big breakthrough story that I had that like really made my career was I figured out that former Congressman Madison Cawthorn, I don't know if y'all remember him, he's not in office anymore.
But, I do. I used to work on the Hill.
Okay. I wrote it for The Nation, but I figured out that he had been misleading about claiming to be training to be a Paralympian. And I think that I noticed that because I'm part of the disability community and I know people who are actual Paralympians. And so when I started digging into like his claims and how he talked about it and like people in the community, I just found all this wild stuff. Like it was just like looking at it, like it just was very obvious to me. But because the other reporters reporting on him didn't have that experience, like they just didn't notice. They just figured, okay, like he's kind of buff and he's in a wheelchair. So sure, Paralympics. But like actually Paralympians are like, they're extremely elite athletes and they're also, they all know each other. So what I found out during my reporting was that not only did they were actually aware of Madison Cawthorn, but they like all laughed at him because he claimed to be a Paralympian before he ever ran for office. I think another way that being autistic informs my reporting is that, so I think there's been like a lot of conversation about autism and empathy. So I'm going to say what I say, and I recognize that it's not necessarily something that works for everyone or that everyone will agree with, but traditionally autism is seen as like there is like an empathy component to it. Like the idea is that like autistic people have difficulty reading how other people think and feel. And I think that is true for me, but I also think that there's a difference between like different kinds of empathy. So there's affective empathy, which is like being able to read what someone else is putting down. It's their facial expressions, their posture, their tone of voice, kind of the nonverbal cues that they're putting out. And then there's cognitive empathy, which is the process of thinking through how another person feels, what it is like to be in their shoes. And I think that, at least for me, being autistic means that while I struggle with affective empathy, I have very good cognitive empathy because I've had to be conscious about it and work on it. So when I talk to people and interview them, I always go through a process where I think about what is it like to be this person. And I think that for a lot of people who aren't on the spectrum, that process is like very reflexive and natural for them so that they don't actually have to think about it. And so I think that like in that respect, it actually makes me less judgmental as an interviewer. It makes it easier to talk to people who have very different viewpoints than I do and to just like hear what they have to say, because I really have to think about feeling what this other person feels as a conscious exercise.
Probably allows for you to get perspectives that are not available to others who are just going through a series of interview questions and might not necessarily have shared those perspectives. I can definitely see that. And I think we know that like the evidence, at least my read of some of the evidence of caregivers from like the medical perspective, kind of the clinical perspective of autism, is that has been very helpful in kind of interdisciplinary care of both children and adults with autism when their providers, whether they be clinicians or other allied health professionals, also share the disorder. So it's emerging in many aspects, and certainly in your interviewing, it sounds like.
I don't even think it's necessarily that like people are more willing to talk to me. I think sometimes it's just that I am willing to ask. So for example, a couple years ago, I interviewed this guy named Brandon Will for this article about he's caring for his mom. She has Parkinson's disease. They were having trouble finding an in-home caregiver, like a home health aide, who was willing to get the COVID vaccine. So the article was about folks like struggling to find folks to care for their older disabled relatives who, you know, had been vaccinated. He had talked to reporters before. I was the first person that ever asked to talk to his mom.
Everyone interviewed him and nobody actually ever asked to speak to her.
Yeah. So Parkinson's disease can have like a little bit of a cognitive aspect sometimes. Like it does impact how people speak. My grandfather had it. But like she gave a great interview. She had really interesting things to say about her experience. And no one had thought to ask her because I think to some extent, like people see caregiving as like this top-down, unidirectional sort of thing where like you only need to talk to the caregiver. It's like a subject object. But really, it's a relationship. The person doing the care and the person receiving the care are both in conversation with each other, and both of those pieces are really important. And so that's another way. I don't think it's just that I like people are more willing to talk to me. It's that I'm more willing to ask.
Mm-hmm. And more willing to ask questions of people that we don't get to hear from.
Yeah.
which is so important. So I do want to talk a little bit about caregivers with the understanding that it is not, you know, one direction, right? It's not top down. So when you've interviewed caregivers of people with autism, what are some of the barriers and challenges that have been universal across the board when they're talking to you about how they care for the person in their lives so that they can have functionality, so that they can take part in living?
So I've actually found very little conflict in that respect. I do think that there's like this idea that autistic adults in particular and like parents of autistic kids are like somehow oppositional. I do think there are some folks online that like to yell at each other. I just find that when I go and I talk to real people in real life, that's not how it is. 9 times out of 10, when I talk to a parent of an autistic kid, they want exactly the same things that I would want. Like they want their child to be as independent as possible. They want their child to have access to employment, or if their child can't work, they want their child to have access to like meaningful daytime activities that are relevant to their interests and like personalized. They want their kid to exist in the world. So I don't find a lot of conflict in that respect. Like sometimes people will like use words that I wouldn't personally use. For example, like I've been calling myself autistic and you guys have been using person with autism. There's this thing called person first language that's like very common in medical settings where like the idea is that you put the person first as a sign of respect. I call myself autistic because I use identity first language, which was pioneered by the deaf community. The idea is to say that being autistic is part of my identity. And it's inseparable from who I am. And these are both valid approaches. Different disability communities like to do it different ways. But if a parent uses those words, like, it doesn't mean they disagree with me. That's not important. The words aren't important. The substance and the content are what's important.
Yeah, that makes sense. In terms of the substance and the content, right, and this desire for caregivers to want the people in their lives, whether or not it's a child or a partner, to live as full a life as possible, right? Because we all have the right to really live as full a life as possible. What are some of the challenges that people within that caregiving community have reported to you facing in terms of finding a place that, you know, folks can spend time during the day that's respectful, finding activities for people across the age spectrum, right? Because so in my work, we work more with younger children who have autism up to, I'd say, in the 20s. And it's totally different for someone who's 20, 30, 40, 50. So what are some of those barriers or challenges that caregivers have reported to you that are, I'd say, you know, widespread and not unique to individuals?
Autism is a spectrum. There's a very wide variety of different needs that people have. So obviously, like one parent's experience is not going to be like another parent's experience. One autistic person's experience is not going to be like another autistic person's experience. But there are some like common issues, I think, across the board. A lot of these things are structural problems. I think like one of the biggest ones that adults are dealing with right now, adults with higher support needs, so folks who need more help in their everyday lives, is something called the HCBS waiting list. So HCBS stands for Home and Community-Based Services. It's like basically you have someone come to your house and help you do what are called activities of daily living. So like, you know, eating, keeping your house clean. Sometimes they help with stuff like you know, doing your taxes even. Just making sure that all this stuff that you need to like live your life gets done. And so most states have waiting lists for these services that can be years long. So there's over 700,000 people across the nation waiting for these HCBS services. And so what ends up happening is family caregivers like parents end up doing, and usually moms, this disproportionately falls on women, end up doing a lot of unpaid labor to help make sure that their adult kids are able to live. And it shouldn't have to be that way. Like they are entitled to these services, but they're not adequately funded. So these waiting lists exist.
There's also, as I've seen, especially with children, that there's been this sometimes, I think, very unfortunate framing of autism as something that needs to find a cure. There needs to be a cure. And there's always this conversation about cures for autism, a lot of misinformation wrapped into trying to achieve that goal. How have you kind of found this, again, in thinking about your reporting and your stories, personal experience, this concept of a cure?
I've had the privilege to do a lot of reporting about autism research. And the thing about finding a cure is I don't know if it's possible. I feel like this argument over like cure or no cure is like a little bit odd, because the more we learn about autism genetically, like the more we find that it is just incredibly complicated. And so I don't know if it's even possible to cure autism. So I just feel like it's kind of like arguing about whether elephants can wear earmuffs. Like, it doesn't feel like a real conversation to me. I do think for like the large stretch of like autism research funding that there has been like a very disproportionate focus on cure. And I think that largely has to do with like who's funding autism research.
And who is that?
I mean, so it started off with like wealthy parents who wanted to cure their kids. And I don't think that that's necessarily like harmful. Mm-hmm. I understand that like people want their kids to have good lives. But I think the misunderstanding that happens is like, if your kid didn't have autism anymore, they would be a different person, a person that doesn't exist. One of the founders of the neurodiversity community, Jim Sinclair, wrote this essay that was very foundational. They wrote this essay called "Don't Mourn for Us" that talks about you can't separate the person from the autism. Autism is not a shell that there's a normal person inside of. It is pervasive. It impacts every part of your experience. I feel like there's like this like messianic expectation that some people have that there will be a cure one day and then you will have a normal child. And it's not real. And I wish that people would let it go. I just feel like the research that I've seen indicates that it might not even be possible. And also, you would end up with a different child.
We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we'll hear more from reporter Sarah Luderman on the way that care has evolved for autistic people.
You're listening to Well Now from Slate. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. And we're continuing our conversation with reporter Sarah Luderman about wellness and autism. So, okay, Sarah, let's talk a little bit about how care for autistic people has changed over the past few years. How does it compare to the way that things have been done in the past?
So, before I was a journalist, I worked for an intellectual and developmental disability organization called AUCD, the Association of University Centers on Disability. And I had the privilege of being the assistant to this woman named Liz Weintraub, who has intellectual disability and cerebral palsy. And her husband has what was then called pervasive developmental disability not otherwise specified, which today I think would probably be identified as autism.
My personal definition of self-advocacy is that, and this is a dream, is that we all need to work together and we can't separate ourselves anymore. But then that also means that we can be who we are.
They were institutionalized. That is how it was for autistic people for a very long time. You would end up in like a state hospital where you would lead this very enclosed life and you wouldn't be part of the world. There's also in the early 90s, this thing that developed called the self-advocacy movement. The self-advocacy movement was made up of folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, which included autism, who basically wanted to be able to have more control in their own lives, make their own choices, be able to choose what they want to eat for lunch, decide where they want to live, what color to paint the walls in their rooms, like just really basic stuff that I think a lot of people don't think about. And Liz was part of that movement. And so it was just like an honor to like be part of her life and follow her around. I feel like I learned a lot from it because she grew up in institutions in, you know, a segregated school that was, it was a boarding school, so she didn't go home very often. She led this very separate and closed life for most of her life. But now she lives with her husband. They have an apartment. She's doing hill work. They still need a lot of help doing things, but they're able to lead much more independent lives because they have the resources and because they've been treated like they can lead much more independent lives. So I think that's like part of the movement that's happened, deinstitutionalization and like a greater movement towards more independent living. The other thing that's happened is the neurodiversity movement. The neurodiversity movement was established in the late 90s by folks like Jim Sinclair, who I referenced earlier. And the basic premise of it is that people with cognitive differences are full people, that we deserve the same rights that other people deserve, that we deserve self-determination, the ability to make choices. It's a little bit different than the self-advocacy movement, because I think the self-advocacy movement was focused more on folks who have like higher support needs and were facing more institutional living. Whereas the neurodiversity movement was a little bit broader and encompassed things like what used to be called Asperger syndrome. So the neurodiversity movement was a big sea change, because like the push there is to see autism in less of a medical way, to see it as like less of a disorder and more of a difference, like a way that people, a different way of being. I think that that shift has actually had a very big cultural impact. The fact that the president put out a proclamation earlier this month for the first time calling it Autism Acceptance Month is huge, because that push to change was by a member of the neurodiversity movement named Paula Durbin Wesley. And that is language now that the president of the United States has used. There's just been like a huge sea change in how we talk about autism. The push has been to like change the narrative so that it is less about how horrible it is to have an autistic person in your life, how much they need to be fixed and cured, and how much we need the solution to come that will make them a different person that's easier to handle. It's just been a huge change, even just the last few years, in how people talk about autism.
Sarah, has care changed? You talk about how clinical things were and how, and that's unfortunately how much of, I still see that kind of narrow, you know, lens. Have you felt like in both your reporting and experience that care has also reflected that change?
So I do think that like the expansion of home and community-based services does reflect that change. The idea that people should have care in their own homes, that they should live in regular neighborhoods with regular people in regular communities instead of like separate special places locked away. That's been, in terms of like care delivery, I think the big shift. I don't think it's unique to neurodiversity. I think that the self-advocacy movement has played a huge role there. I think the independent living movement, which was mostly pushed by people with physical disabilities, has had a huge role. There's just been like this big shift to try to normalize the lives of folks with higher support needs. And I think that's been really exciting to see as well.
And where do you feel like we are? Where do you feel like we're going? Like, what changes do you want to see continue to happen?
Well, I'm not an advocate. I'm a journalist. Obviously, I'm not going to pretend I don't have opinions, because that's obviously a lie to anybody. I don't like the thing where we're supposed to pretend that we don't think things, because I think that like for readers and listeners, like, they're smart. They know that's not true. They know that we have opinions. But I don't know. I think that I am excited to see how home and community-based services continue to expand. I wrote this piece for The Nation a few years ago called It's Time to Abolish Nursing Homes, that talks about this shift away from institutional living to more individualized in-home service delivery. And I really do believe that is where service delivery is going for folks who need that kind of support. It might take a while to get there. A lot of it has to do with funding. A lot of it has to do with funding. It's hard to say when that will happen, but I do think it's the general shape of things. It's how the arc of history is going, in my opinion.
And Sarah, since we started, I think you did a nice job when I asked you about wellness, kind of describing just exactly what you feel like brings you joy. What are other ways that autistic persons have been able to find joy? In your reporting, do you mind telling us about stories of, or any anecdotes that you can share around how they have found joy, especially in this very ableist society that has an incredibly long way to go, not just in support, diagnosis, caregiving, all aspects for autistic people.
Yeah. So, and a lot of autistic folks pretty much across the spectrum have what sometimes get called special interests. I know there are some folks in the neurodiversity movement who prefer intense interest. And I think that, like, for a lot of folks, being able to lean into that is a kind of an easy way to get joy. For folks with higher support needs, having someone in their lives, like a parent or a family member or a support person who is committed to helping them be as autonomous as possible is really important. Having an advocate who's in your corner that wants to help you live as full a life as humanly possible. So I recently interviewed this mom named Sylvia Liang at a speech President Biden was giving. And it's actually interesting. She's a family caregiver. So she's caring for her son, who's 35. His name is Brian. He has autism. I think that's the language he prefers. And I loved talking to her because she's just so committed to helping her son live a good life. She has made it so that he's learned how to cook recently. She used to do all the cooking for him, and he has started insisting that he cook his own meals. He has a job at a local big box store for a couple hours a week. He does Special Olympics, which he loves doing. He's taking drama classes. Like, he just is able to engage with the community and do all of these things because his mom is so committed to supporting his autonomy and his interests and helping him live in the world. I think that's so important and beautiful. I love interviewing parents like that. And I think that's most parents. Most parents want to give their kids full lives. That's their focus. Like, I think that, like, more and more parents are just getting less stuck on cure and more on how their kids can live full lives as they are.
Sarah Luderman is a reporter covering caregiving for the 19th. Thank you so much for joining us and making us smarter.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show this week. Well Now is produced by Vic Whitley Berry and Ayana Angel. Ben Richmond is Slate Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio.
If you have a wellness story you want us to cover, email us at wellnow@slate.com. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday as we tackle another part of the wellness industry. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. Thanks for listening.